Thank you. Good afternoon or good morning to those of you on the West, and welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Jennifer Simone, and I'll be moderating today's seminar. Today's topic is the 2013 Supply Chain State of Logistics Report. Before I go any further, I do want to remind you, those of you who are calling into the teleconference for the audio, that you do need to mute your computer speakers, or else you'll be hearing the audio over the computer as well. Today we'll have two presenters, Roz Wilson of the Delcan Corporation and Libby Ogard of Prime Focus LLC. Roz Wilson is an internationally recognized supply chain expert with more than 30 years of experience in the transportation and logistics field. She analyzes the performance of logistics and supply chain industry sectors, identifies and analyzes key issues facing the transportation industry, and provides insight to government and corporate entities and the press. She is a widely recognized expert in transportation economics and supply chain security. She has extensive railroad industry experience and has served in various capacities for over 11 years at the Association of American Railroads. She has more than 10 years experience in supply chain security and resiliency and 6 years experience in information security for defense and national security clients. She is the author of the 24-year-old Annual State of Logistics Report, a widely used analysis of the supply chain industry published by the Council of Supply Chain Management Professionals and Penske Logistics. She analyzes trends and provides commentary for the monthly Cass Freight Indexes. In 2006, Roz co-authored Securing Global Transportation Networks, a supply chain security reference and college textbook, which is currently under revision. Libby Ogard is president of Prime Focus LLC and has over 30 years of experience in freight operations and logistics, including managing freight operations and performance levels for private industry and managing transportation data exchange between shippers and carriers. She spent 18 years at the Class I Railroad and 7 years at the North America's second largest truckload carrier, Schneider National. In her time at Schneider National, she managed rail on-time performance to 95% and customer delivery on-time performance to 98% for Walgreens, Family Dollar, Target, and Home Depot shippers for international, domestic, private fleet, and specialized shipments. She is a past president of the Council of Supply Chain Management Professionals Chicago Roundtable. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated for the speakers and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, you can type it into the chat area. Please make sure you send your question to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. The presenters will not be answering the questions during the presentations, but I'll start off the Q&A session with the question typed into the chat box. If we run out of time and are unable to address all questions, we'll attempt to get written responses from the presenters to the unanswered questions. The PowerPoint presentations used during the seminar are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen. The presentations will also be available online within the next few weeks, along with a recording and a transcript. I'll notify all attendees once these materials are posted online. One final note, Talking Freight seminars are eligible for 1.5 certification maintenance credits for AICP members. In order to obtain credit for today's seminar, you must have logged in with your first and last name, or if you're attending with a group of people, have your name typed into the chat box. I've included more detailed instructions in the file share box on how to obtain your credits after the seminar. Today's webinar is available on the AICP website. For those of you who are not AICP members but would like to receive PDH credits for this webinar, please note that FHWA does not formally offer PDHs. However, it may be possible to receive them for your participation if you are able to self-certify. To possibly receive credits, please download the agenda from the file download box and submit it to your respective licensing agency. Finally, I also encourage everyone to download the evaluation form from the file share box and submit it to me after the webinar. So we'll now go ahead and get started with our first presenter, Roz Wilson of Delcan Corporation. Roz, I'll bring up your presentation and you can go ahead.
Okay. Welcome, and thank you very much for inviting me to be here today to do this. So what I'm going to be talking about today is the Annual State of Logistics Report. This presentation is based on an annual report that was created in the 1985 by Bob Delaney, a man who was really passionate about the freight industry and a very big proponent of deregulation. He actually created this model to measure the impact of deregulation on the various sectors of the industry. So the model has three major components. First, it has inventory carrying costs. That includes the interest and other costs on the inventory, but not the actual cost of the inventory themselves. Then there's transportation costs, which includes all modes, including non-asset carriers or providers. other countries have copied the methodology, and it's now in use in about a dozen or more economies globally. So the cost of U.S. business logistics system rose 3.4% in 2012. That's still short of the peak 2000, or the most recent peak 2007 level. Business logistics costs increased to $1.33 trillion, and that was up $43 billion from 2011. So 2012 continued many of the same trends we've been experiencing since 2010, following the end of the recession. At the end of June, the economy will have celebrated its fourth full year of recovery. You're probably thinking that there really hasn't been a lot to celebrate. Once again, 2012 can be characterized by a lack of sustained growth in the economy and, by extension, the freight sector. Now that we're 4 years out and the economy is still experiencing low to slow growth, unemployment levels remain relatively high, job creation is weak and focused on lower quality jobs, freight volumes and rates have been inconsistent, and the trends rarely move in the same direction for more than a couple of months, and the global economy has ratcheted down considerably, I'm wondering if it's time to ask if this is the new normal. Other than the Great Depression, no other financial or economic event in the U.S. has created the level of upheaval and economic restructuring as the Great Recession did between 2007 and 2009. During that period, households lost close to 50% of their net worth, millions lost their jobs, and we learned to get the same amount of work done with fewer people. Sectors of the economy were made lean or right-sized, for instance, the truck and cargo jet fleet, and retail inventories were trimmed considerably. Supply chain practices were adapted to be even more mode-agnostic to make the best use of the available capacity, reduce costs, and bring out still more productivity. Entire industries have to remake themselves following a less labor-intensive cost model that have increased the use of technology to improve quality, but also cut out laborers to cut costs. The U.S. automotive industry in Detroit is a prime example of this. Foreign manufacturers built plants in the U.S. years ago, proving that vehicles could be manufactured here at a competitive price. Detroit automakers had to adjust or perish. I think the single biggest accomplishment resulting from the Great Recession is increased productivity across almost all sectors of the economy. Everywhere we've learned to do more with less. Unfortunately, the increased productivity has, in many cases, reduced the need to rehire laid-off workers. Many businesses invested in better software or process redesign rather than invest in human capital. It's much less traumatic to shut off a machine than it is to fire a person. I believe that we're experiencing a new order that is translating into the new way of life for the economy and the logistics and supply chain sectors for the foreseeable future. The new normal is characterized by slow growth, with GDP growth hovering between 2.5 to 4%. Higher unemployment levels and slow job creation will continue, and higher healthcare costs for businesses are encouraging extremely lean full-time staff and a higher reliance on part-time workers who generally don't receive those benefits. Freight service will be less reliable or predictable as volumes rise, especially during periods when capacity doesn't increase fast enough to fully meet demand. And commodities moving by ocean will have longer and possibly irregular shipping times. Household net worth and disposable income is expanding very slowly when compared to the growth rates for the decades leading up to the recession, which is recognizing that consumers are much more risk-averse now. Consumer credit is expanding at a slower rate and is showing signs of leveling off well below pre-recession totals. Household savings rates are rising, and consumers are a lot more careful about how they spend their money, if they have any extra after the necessity. Another example of a change trend is the phasing out of the traditional peak holiday season. Recent peak shipping seasons have either been almost undetectable or so protracted that their impact is minimal on capacity and rates. The change the way we manage and distribute our inventory is online shopping has exploded. Along the way, we learned that real-time transparency on distribution networks allows us to fulfill orders faster with lower inventory. The same inventory is used to fill store orders and online orders. If the store doesn't have an item in the color or size you want, your order can be placed right at the store. between supply and demand, with very few shortages reported, but an industry high utilization rate. Qualified truck drivers have become a valuable commodity in very short supply, which is becoming more of an issue as the shortage grows from 30,000 drivers today to an estimated 115,000 needed by 2016. Ocean carriers continue to manage their excess capacity while battling unfavorable load factors and downward rate pressure. Despite reductions in the number of cargo aircraft, the air cargo industry is still battling for capacity, which has been made worse by the increased availability of cargo space in the bellies of passenger jets as we all load our suitcases into the overhead bins. Railroads, on the other hand, are operating quite comfortably and still have about 20% of their freight cars in storage. The employment rate began to edge down in 2012, but I think something to look at that's more important than the unemployment rate is the employment population ratio, which is the percentage of adult Americans who hold a job, and that hasn't budged in 3 years. In fact, it's at the lowest rate that it's been since 1983, about 57%, according to the U.S. Department of Labor. The adult population in the U.S. increased by about 200,000 people per month, but we've only been averaging about 172,000 new jobs per month. So our job creation rate isn't even covering our population increase, much less recovering the jobs that we lost. The U.S. economy lost an estimated 8.7 million jobs during the recession and has only recovered about 6.3 million of those. And as I said, the jobs that are being created are supposed to be part-time jobs, which really aren't the kinds of jobs we need to get the economy moving the way it was before the recession. Looking at this in a different, kind of more visual way, there are 12 million Americans unemployed. That's the equivalent of the populations of New York City and Los Angeles combined, according to a pictograph that I was looking at and recently in CNN Money. 8 million Americans are underemployed. That means they want to work full-time, but they're only able to get part-time. That's the equivalent of combining the populations of Chicago, Houston, Philadelphia, and Phoenix. And then there's approximately 2 million Americans who have dropped out of the job market, discouraged workers, that sort of thing, and that's the equivalent of Dallas and San Francisco's populations combined. So those numbers are really staggering, and those graphic images help me begin to grasp the implications of that. Per capita personal income rose 2.7% in 2012. Much of that gain, however, was in the stock market, which tends to benefit richer folks, if you will. Middle-class families' wealth is more tied up in their homes rather than investments, and housing values are still 26% below their peak. Household wealth is still 6% below its peak. Household debt as a percentage of disposable income has been dropping. In 2011, it moved up just a little bit because more people dipped into their savings. However, in 2012, the savings rate began to move back up again. So, U.S. exports of goods increased by 4.6% in 2012, while imports rose 2.8%. That's considerably slower than the growth that we experienced in 2011, but it still represents record highs for both exports and imports. Interestingly, we've increased our exports by 39.1% since 2009, when President Obama called for a doubling of U.S. exports. And also in 2012, the U.S. imported 3.09 billion barrels of crude oil, down 6.7% from the quantity imported in 2011. And looking at all crude oil, not just fuel oil, the U.S. was actually a net exporter in 2012. So let's get down into the business logistics system. So as I said, in 2012, business logistics increased 3.4%, and that meant that the logistics as a cost of nominal GDP remained at the 2011 level of 8.5%. And what this means is that the freight logistics sector was growing at about the same rate as GDP. The mentioned, GDP has always been a magic number, and it's the number that everybody looks for every year when this report phase comes out. When Bob Delaney first started this, we were in the 14, 15, 18% range of logistics as a percentage of GDP until we started to get the hang of deregulation. Once we got the hang of deregulation, it started falling, and Bob and I had always thought that 10% was the goal to be shooting for. Well, by the late 1990s and early 2000s, we actually not only met that goal, but began to fall below 10 as we really started getting the hang of globalization and managing our inventories and a lot of different things. However, that drop from 9.4 to 7.9 that you see from 2008 to 2009, and then as we've been beginning to slowly climb back up, those really don't represent a healthy level. That's truly the drop off in the amount of freight that we're handling in the system, and not necessarily a representative of what we're doing. That we're doing things better. Although, as I said, we have learned some very valuable lessons and have improved a lot of things. So, logistics cost as a percent of GDP, as I said, is measured in a variety of countries, and I just thought you might be interested in seeing how well we're doing against other industrialized countries and growing countries, growing areas, to see exactly how well we really do things. And this gives us our market advantage in the global economy. So this is just a look at the entire model before I dive into the details of the components. So carrying costs in total were up 4%. Transportation costs, which is the largest piece of the model, were up 3%. And again, the total overall was up 3.4%. So starting with the inventory carrying piece, inventory carrying costs posted a 4% gain. Interest rates went up yet again, and inventory levels inched up. All business inventories rose in 3 out of 4 quarters in 2012, falling only during the second quarter. Inventory levels have surpassed the previous high point, which was established in the at the height of the recession. So I didn't draw the line across, but it's not a very good sign, really, that our inventories are back up at where they were right before the recession started, but there are some good reasons, which we can discuss here by looking at the individual components. You can see the green line, which is retail sales, that's been fairly flat, or relatively flat, because once inventories got cleared out, retailers, they pushed inventory back down the chain in the hands of wholesale trade and manufacturing, and they expect them to deliver them in that just-in-time sort of way. And so one thing that you see right here is the wholesale manufacturing, which previously had always been lower. If you go back all the way to the beginning of the series, up until you see that cross in the beginning of 2009, wholesale inventories have always been smaller than retail inventories. Now that retailers are not holding much extra inventory on their floors or in the back, you see this growth in wholesale trade. That growth is, part of it is people need to, the wholesalers don't quite have the hang of predicting things as well as retail seems to be doing right now. Of course, retail has that margin of error because they're forcing the wholesalers to hang on to it. So I expect to see that improve over time. Also, with the length of time that it takes to have commodities in place, and the retailers are expecting the wholesalers to be able to provide that inventory when they need it, they're having to hold more. The reason you see the growth, I think, in the manufacturing side of things is because of the low interest rates for holding inventory. I think manufacturers purchased ahead because of the low cost of having that inventory and being able to be in anticipation of being ready when the economy picks up. So this next slide is called the retail inventory sales ratio. And what that actually does is it measures how well we're doing and customers want, and having the right mix on the floor and the velocity with which the inventory is moving off the shelf. A high inventory to sales ratio means that inventory is piling up. Unsold inventory generally has to be discounted or becomes obsolete, meaning that value is lost. Also, the cost to store that inventory rises with warehouse rent, taxes on inventory, and insurance costs. So you want a low inventory to sales ratio. And unfortunately, it's been climbing up since about the middle of 2012, and it's continued to sort of bump up and down here in 2013. And some of that has to do with sales, you know, we've had such a bumpy ride. Sales have picked up, then they've abruptly dropped off. Again, I talked about that trickle-down effect. So when sales drop off in retail, that means wholesale is beginning to hold more inventory. So it has a trickle-down effect in the economy. The cost of carrying inventory is determined not only by the value of those inventories, but also by the interest rate for holding those inventories. We happen to use the annualized commercial paper rate from the Federal Reserve as the interest component for this. And that fell every year. I said it could possibly fall again because, as you can see, it's bouncing right on the bottom. But it managed to fall again in 2012. It fell from 0.13% to 0.11%. So as long as we've got interest bumping along down there, carrying inventory is actually a much lower cost. So I'm going to move into the transportation piece now. As I said, transportation costs were up 3.0% in 2012. We used carrier revenues to measure the cost to shippers in the model. Almost posted a modest revenue increase in 2012, but neither rate nor volume growth was particularly strong during the year. And the first half of the year was better than the second half of the year, as you can see from this graphic for trucks. Trucking is the largest single component of transportation costs, and it posted only a 2.9% rise over 2012. The intercity truck segment was up 3.2%, and the local delivery segment was up 2.1%. Truck tonnage increased only 2.3% in 2012. Again, uneven performance is the pattern for the news. The trucking industry has that very delicate supply. Demand balance going right now, which could be thrown out of whack a little bit by the new hours of service rules. The new hours of service rules are expected to reduce productivity by reducing the number of hours that the current drivers that we have are able to drive. The new restart rule represents theoretically a 17% reduction in the standard work week. There are a lot of estimates out there. It's been in effect since July 1st, and we really don't have anything to measure at this point. So I'm not going to talk a lot about that because it's conjecture. The big thing to look at, I think, is truck sales were soaring in early 2012, but the orders came to an abrupt end as traffic slowed. Used equipment is really scarce, and the prices have been bid up almost to the point where a new truck with better gas mileage and other features may be a better investment. Purchases are only being made to replace equipment being retired rather than any trucking company to add to their fleet. The exception to that is new equipment that's being added to fleet to meet the increasing number of dedicated carriage contracts, and that means that you have hired a trucking company as if they were working for you, so they're the dedicated carrier. So you know you're going to get that business, so therefore you have those trucks. And despite the shrinking fleet, carriers are still reporting difficulty finding enough drivers. The U.S. Labor Department forecasts that truck drivers will account for 43% of the growth in general logistics jobs in the coming years. But this is the job category with the fewest potential workers trained to fill them. Only about 17% of our current driver population is under 35, and a much larger portion of the driver population is reaching retirement age. And I think there's a number of factors that are affecting driver supply. One of them is the stricter qualifications and the high cost of training. The told me jobs, you know, like personal service jobs like lawnmower or handyman, that sort of thing, and has been enabling them to get by just fine. Also, private fleet owners are facing the same aging population, and so they've been attracting some of the most desirable drivers from the other side with better paying working conditions. And also, there's a lot more drayage work available, which is work closer to home. So that's some of the reasons that we're seeing some of the problems with hiring drivers. So just making a quick recap of the rail industry, rail transportation was up 4.9%. That's down substantially from the 2011 increase of more than 16%. 10 miles decreased 1% in 2012. Total carloads for the year fell 3.1% compared to 2011. And intermodal volume was the second highest on record. The average length of haul has been dropping for railroads, and both average tons per carload and average tons per train fell in 2012. The railroad industry is in a very good position as far as capacity goes. They continue to invest throughout the entire recession and recovery, and they have sufficient equipment and personnel to handle what's in front of them. Costs for the water sector declined 0.9% in 2012. So very disappointing, another very disappointing year for ocean carriers. Their vessel capacity jumped up 7.2% as demand fell off very sharply globally. Deliveries of new ships doesn't really fall off until 2014 because carriers didn't stop ordering them until about mid-2011. The capacity is expected to rise by another 10% in 2013, making it really difficult to deploy the new vessels without further damaging the industry's dynamics. They had a round in general of rate increases in March of last year that they were able to hold for a little while, but dwindling volumes forced them to abandon that and engage in a very brutal rate war using spot rates and put them farther in the hole. At one point in 2012, about 5.8% of the fleet was idle in an attempt to shore up rates. When rates firmed up after March, the ships were redeployed, dropping the idle rate to 3.7, but by October, the idle fleet had grown back up to 3.7%. And they're engaging in something that's called slow steaming right now. In fact, it's become the norm. Slow steaming is allegedly done or was originally done as a way of saving fuel when fuel prices were rising. Now it's really done to reduce costs in general. And what it means is they're not heading across the water as fast as they can possibly go. And between the slow steaming and the irregular schedules when ships are trying to add more containers on, things are becoming very irregular and unpredictable in the ocean side. On that slide, we saw something called the Jones Act that's been active debate again. The Jones Act is, I can't remember off the top of my head how old the act is, but it requires ships operating in the U.S. like being able to do coastwise traffic up and down the coast or between coast or the coast and the Gulf. They have to be U.S.-built, U.S.-crewed, and U.S.-registered. And for a variety of reasons, including we're not the world's leading ship makers, and we tend to have higher-cost employees, that usually makes the Jones Act ships at a disadvantage. However, if you're not a Jones Act carrier, another international carrier cannot come in and take that kind of coast-wise shipping. So even though you see a ship that moves from port to port, it is unloading or loading for international. It cannot take domestic traffic between the ports that it's calling on. This is just a quick show to show you that U.S. ports didn't quite have the great year that they had in 2011. So moving on now to inland waterways, the tonnage on inland waterways was significantly higher in the first half of the year of 2012 than it's been for quite some time. But as you can see from this graph, it fell off dramatically in the second half of the year. A lot of that having to do with the drought as well as global volumes, shipping volumes dropping, and therefore orders were dropping. There were numerous times when sections of the, particularly the Mississippi, could be traveled only in one direction at a time because the width of the channel wouldn't support the birch tow in each direction, despite the fact that the Army Corps of Engineers was providing emergency dredging. Barges were often backed up for days at a time awaiting passage. At one point, there were close to 100 vessels that, or close to 100 vessels ran aground in the lower Mississippi, each of those causing between hours and days of delays. Shallower channels meant lighter loads, slower speeds, and fewer barges in a tow, any of which would run up costs. Several harbors were closed at the height of the drought because of the reduced draft, and it's estimated that every inch of draft loss represents thousands of tons of products that can't be moved. An 11-mile stretch of the Mississippi River was closed intermittently in August, causing queues of up to 100 tows. Every single day a towboat is idle cost the owners $10,000, so no surprise that grain shipping rates increased close to 25% during that period. So just to show you how important the waterways really are, take a look at this modal comparison chart and look at what you can move on one barge compared to what you can move on railroad hopper cars or trucks or in one barge tow. So as you can see, we should be using the water part of our system a lot more efficiently, I think, than we are. And then just to bring it home, look at the 10 miles traveled per gallon of fuel based on various modes. And I think looking at that really makes you want to understand or figure out ways that we can use our waterways more effectively. Here's a map of what's called the marine highways now, and look at the extent of this. We can reach a lot of places that we are currently reaching by truck and by rail, but look at what we can divert off and reduce the need for more investment in some of those. They have direct connections with seaports. They've got great environmental benefits, but on the downside, most of the lock infrastructure has already exceeded its expected life. So we need to fix the aging infrastructure, and then we need to build more landside infrastructure to support containers on barges and for transloading to other roads. And I think with some very well-placed funding along our inland waterways, we could really dramatically reduce the need for some funding that we have in other areas. One mode that I'll talk in here, but we're not going to discuss it any real length, is oil pipelines. And oil pipeline ton miles were virtually flat, but the rate part of that industry is still regulated, and they had an upward rate adjustment last year, so pipeline revenue was up 8.3%. So moving on to air freight revenue increased 3.1% in 2012, whereas tonnage was dropping 2.2%. The big thing that's happening with air cargo right now is, despite the fact that they dramatically reduced their fleet to improve their yield factors, as the passenger airlines added all the charges for checking our baggage, so we're now carrying our baggage on board, that increased the amount of space available in the belly of the aircraft, and passenger jets now are skimming off the screen, if you will, in domestic cargo, and belly cargo is very profitable because basically the cost to move the aircraft is already covered with the passenger revenue, and so their profits are estimated to be close to 65%. So they're marketing that very, very aggressively. Another very important part contractors who shippers, they arrange all the carriage, and so they tend to be very mode agnostic. They're looking for the cheapest way to move that freight, whether it's a combination of rail or truck or whatever mode, you know, to move it on a donkey if you can make it cost effective. So this is a growing part of the industry. They did have their low spot when there really wasn't a lot to move in 2009, but for the most part, you see they've been climbing. And they've been climbing because the more difficult environment we are in, the more shippers want to concentrate on what their core business is and let the people that do the logistics piece, the transportation piece, best do what they do. So we've seen an increase. And if you take a look at the next slide, the market, the 3PL market can be broken into these four segments. And the segment that's been growing the fastest has been domestic transportation management. And that's because more and more carriers, especially as they are beginning to anticipate that we could have some capacity problems, are beginning to engage 3PL companies. They're generally non-asset, so they don't have to worry about the asset utilization when they're making their decisions about how things are going to be moved. And so I've actually talked with several companies that have hired more than one 3PL in the expectation that there will be some truck shortages, and they want to be engaged and have put themselves in such a position that they know that what they need will be available. So looking at what's happened so far in 2013, we sort of had a slow start as far as manufacturing went. In fact, manufacturing was contracting for a good part of the first half of the year, but it has started expanding in the last couple of months. New orders are back up, production is back up, but the backlog of orders is still declining. One of the things I always look at in terms of figuring out what we're going to be moving here in the U.S. in the coming months is what's going on in China. And China's PMI rose last month after about 5 months in a row of decline. But if you actually take a closer look at their PMI, only their domestic part was up. Their new export orders and their backlog are still contracting, and that means we're not placing orders. So if we're not placing orders, there aren't going to be things here for us to move. Signs that the economy has been strengthening have been a growing number of new jobs created. Existing home sales and residential construction was up a bit in the first half. Exports have been growing despite the shaky state of the global economy. And I think that we're going to have something that we may be able to call a holiday peak shipping season this year, but we might change it to a holiday bump, because I don't think it's going to be very big, but unlike other periods, it may be measurable. The things to sort of look at that are on the negative side is a lot of that employment growth has been in part-time jobs. Our freight volumes have been really volatile, and inventories are high, and they're staying on the shelf longer. And consumer confidence has been rising, but they're still hanging on to their money. So let's just take a look at what freight sector employment has done in the last decade. And you can see it dropped off dramatically after the recession. And it's been climbing steadily, but we're still not anywhere near where we were before. But we're at an adequate level, a pretty good match for what we're actually moving right now. And this illustrates very well what I was talking about, how bumpy volume has been throughout the year. We just don't see any sustained trend in here to be able to say, yes, we're on our way. And I don't think we really are on our way. I think we're going to continue on the bumpy ride that we've had. At least it's a bumpy ride moving up. Another way of looking at this is the Cass Freight Indexes. And one of them measures the expenditures for freight on a monthly basis, and the other measures the number of freight shipments. And I think one of the most interesting things about this graph is looking at how tangled the last 3 years have been, but the fact that we've got the sort of upward climb. finding expenditures for freight really has not really been a reflection of increased rates to any great extent. It has had something to do with, or a lot more to do with, heavier loading. And so while shipments look like they're declining here, loadings are being measured here, and average loadings have increased. We do see a tremendous amount of increased costs on the side of the carriers, and some of this is them trying to recover that, but we're certainly not seeing any rate gouging or increased rates that you normally, from a purely supply and demand point of view, that you would have expected to see in the fuel industry, in the trucking industry. This is just to give you an idea of what others are expecting for the rest of 2013 as far as annual manufacturing growth. And as you can see, there's nothing in these numbers that is to write home about. The only thing that I think is may actually turn out to be not quite as bad as it is here in Europe. Europe just has 2 months in a row that they have had positive economic growth. I don't believe that they're out of the woods by any means, but 2 months in a row of positive growth for the Euro market is actually pretty substantial. So again, I look for the key trends that would tell us whether or not we could expect to see some substantial growth, and I'm really not seeing that in domestic numbers or global numbers. So to sum up, 2012 really wasn't a great year from an economic perspective, but the freight sector saw modest improvements. Current economic conditions globally really don't support a robust outlook, but here in the U.S. we seem to be settling down, manufacturing seems to be picking back up. But as I was preparing my outline to do this year's report, I found that there really wasn't any truly new story to tell. The same observations about moving up and down along the bottom, but never quite getting off the ground, can be made about 2012, 2011, 2010, and most likely, now that we're through 8 months, most likely to 2013. When I studied my last two previous reports, I looked at my expectations for 2013 through 2015. My conclusion was that the trends were not going to be materially different than they've been for the last 3 years. So I do believe that the economy and the logistics sector will slowly regain sustainable momentum, but that we're still going to experience unevenness in growth rates, and that this is the new normal. Ready to pass off to Libby?
Sure.
All right. Well, thank you, Roz. Libby, I'll bring up your presentation next. And Libby, you can go ahead.
Thanks very much. Excellent job, Roz. I always enjoy listening to the State of Logistics Report because there's always new and different aspects that you bring up. So what I wanted to do is kind of recap a little bit of what Roz just told us, which she mostly focused on: what does logistics mean to the economy, and how are changes in trade patterns and regulations going to impact our logistics complex? From this point, I'm going to pick up and focus on how logistics impact public transportation planning, as well as possible uses for the State of Logistics Report. As we all know, freight seeks a path of least resistance and often lowest cost. Reliability is essential for planning as well as site selection. We heard about private sector partnerships between modes and nodes, truck, rail, barges, ships, air cargo, as well as pipelines and warehouses. Across all of those modes, visibility is essential, especially when exceptions occur. Freight transportation contracts are often won or lost based on-time performance. How will changes in freight patterns change public planning efforts in terms of land use, difference in energy distribution, corridors, collaboration? It is evident to me that the private sector is collaborating, but are we as the public sector mirroring that same level of collaboration between DOTs, Economic Development Agency, Department of Labor, and others. We go to the next slide. What I wanted to do is sort of recap in a real visual way what the cost of the hours of service rules and those changes may mean, particularly for state DOTs, corridor managers, and MPOs. If we look at the rules that just went into effect recently, FTR Associates estimates that this policy alone is likely to reduce our driver capacity by approximately 60,000 drivers due to loss of productivity. If we look at a long-haul lane, for example, between Chicago and Houston, which is about 1,091 miles, which should take about 18 hours and 6 minutes, it's normally a two-day trip. Yet, the state of our transportation network, between accidents, congestion, weather delay, detours, construction, or any variety or combination of uncontrollable impacts, can really have a detrimental impact, especially on long-haul traffic lanes of 1,000 miles or more. I also wanted to talk a little bit about warehouse and the first and last mile. This chart basically shows the little black factories and little red distribution centers and shows the delivery. And as Ross talked about in her presentation, between inventory, warehousing costs, and site location, the challenge is if any one of the transportation inputs or interest rates or the volume of inventory changes, so might these distribution patterns. And these are things that are very hard for the public sector to respond to and react to with planning. So one of the items I wanted to bring up is Herbert W. Davis has a group of supply chain managers that participate in an annual survey as well. And if you look at the total transportation costs, so this is the logistics, whether it's rail, boat, barge, or truck, usually amounts to about 50% of the total cost of logistics. If we look at rents and labor, that's about 15%, and inventory costs is about 22%. So this is a very dynamic chart that can change based on the supply chain costs. So I wanted to take a moment to thank a couple of my trusted colleagues who I reached out to a couple days ago and asked them to weigh in on a couple of conclusions I drew from the State of Logistics Report. And together we've crafted 5 takeaways. So I'd like to start with the first is logistics is dynamic. Transportation and mode choices are ultimately made by the customer and or the producer. And while government may influence freight decisions, collaboration is key. Freight projects take a long time, and we need to start early if we're going to be looking at new facilities or new modal connections. The next key point is don't fossilize your plans. This is a great way to keep the private sector engaged. Increasing your logistics IQ increases your credibility and helps you ask the right questions. The State of Logistics Tool is an important document with over 24 years of history and can give us some insights on how we reacted to dynamic changes in the past and if they might be the same path we take forward in the future. Takeaway number 2. More important now than ever, engage your freight advisory committee. Understand that what seems intuitive to you may not be understood by the logistics community. Engage the economic development community, the workforce agencies, chamber of commerce, and the private sector. Understand what's coming your way. An example is the Philadelphia MPO, DDRPC, has recently seen a spike in pipeline activity due to some of the changes shale place, and that is causing them to sort of rethink and relook at some of their local planning priorities. So keep in mind that things change and we need to be flexible as these changes occur. Freight issues extend beyond political boundaries. Rural issues are often different than urban issues, especially along central corridors or critical reshoring and the manufacturing renaissance that we see in Canada comes from. Your working knowledge of these issues will increase your level of discussion with your private sector counterparts and will yield a higher input and discussion about how some of the changes might affect you either locally or on a regional basis. Avoid being out of step with a private sector partner. In the Midwest, there are two examples that come to mind. Number one, windmill blades. We saw a big explosion of windmill blades when we had a stimulus package that was looking at alternative energies, and now that that tax credit has not been renewed, we're seeing a slower movement of these windmill blades and not in the same volume. The same is true for ethanol and the ethanol market. Now that we're hitting sort of the cap on the blending cycle, we're not seeing as much ethanol move because demand is overall lower. Takeaway number three, MAP 21 will drive freight performance measures. The State of Logistics Report can help you tell the story about how logistics demand may impact your road conditions, bottlenecks, reliability, congestion, and safety. This focus will be of interest especially for economic development partners and site selectors. A supply chain risk manager are very concerned about performance on a daily basis and also in times of natural disaster or other disruptions. Performance measures are used in network planning models, and these are very sophisticated tools which will shape the distribution networks that they use today and in the future. Ensure performance measures are directly linked to state or MPO strategies, goals, and objectives. Start small. Mobility is often the place to start. State and MPOs will want to measure performance that matters to their customers, specifically shippers, receivers, carriers, and warehouses, and recognize that rural and urban shippers, receivers, carriers, and warehouses may have very different focuses in terms of the type of commodities that they're moving and the speed with which they need to move this freight. The State of Logistics Report can be a very good tool to help diagram some of the transportation problems that you might see as a result of some of the performance measures that you engage. Takeaway number four. Public-private partnership investors will seek projects to capitalize on these trends. Are you prepared? All trade modes will continue to innovate. Specifically, recently in Chicago, we just did a public-private partnership deal with the Port of Chicago to increase its competitiveness. This will likely increase their participation with pipeline access as well as highways to connect to rail ports, particularly in and around our region. Public-private partnerships, are they done in desperation for funding or to improve efficiency? We all know that budgets are lean, but I think we can also point to some examples, for example, the Chicago Create example, where a project was conceived of to improve efficiency and collaborate among many partners from which investments and additional funding could be used. Know your tools and regulatory environments. Not all states are capable or able to participate in public-private partnerships. This might be something that you can see the trends coming on the horizon, particularly for new intermodal terminals or other types of investments that are coming. If any kind of policy or legislation might change your public-private partnership position, this might be an opportunity to add existing or additional facilities to existing plans that your private partner may be looking at. Tiger grants require match. If we see Tiger grants in the future, ideally, it is important to begin with looking at other examples where we've been able to attract substantial private sector investments, such as the Crescent Corridor as well as the Heartland Corridor, and maybe those kinds of projects would be in the future if we think about them in a broader regional or corridor context. Good freight connections and logistics can be an economic development driver, not a congestion problem to be managed. The fifth and last takeaway is plan for freight as a whole. Avoid silo approaches. Collaboration at all levels is essential, especially between states, MPOs, and other public agencies such as port authorities. Link corridors and intercity connections. Recognize that multimodal aspects of freight and supply chains will require collaboration. also include supply chains within your state, performance goals within the state, and specifically sections 2 and 5 of these state freight plans. The state of logistics reporting is also a good tool to gain traction with your agency policy research, and maybe before you start the plan, this is a good primer to begin with. Private sector discussions are always based on total landed costs, so it's important to consider the supply chain and the logistics costs from producer to consumer, and all the manufacturing and distribution in between first mile to last mile. So with that, I wanted to sum up by saying that more information can be found on the Council of Supply Chain Management Professionals website, which is cscmp.org. If you go onto the website, you can also find a local roundtable, who typically will have events on a monthly basis and will give you an opportunity to hear from experts in the field about logistics and logistics planning. There's also a number of research and white papers hosted online. And there is a research compendium out there that they're interested in basically looking into any kind of logistics issues you may have. The annual conference this year will be held in Denver between October 20th and 26th. And with that, do you have any questions?
I got a stack on time.
I just wanted to add to what Libby said for public sector, particularly local NPOs and that sort of thing, going to your local roundtable is a great way to engage local private sector organizations that place a high value on logistics and cooperating with others that are local.